Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition for cats and dogs. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. Feel free to email me at radiopetlady@gmail.com if you have any questions or topics you'd like Dr. Sean to cover. This show is a production of 8paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. Good evening, Dr. Sean. Another wonderful night looming on Pet Food Advisors.
Yes, it's a great evening. How are you, Tracy?
I'm dandy, thank you. You've mentioned this phrase, which one hears it and thinks, oh, I think I know what that is, but in fact, we don't really. Epigenetics. And I think it has a lot of, something we should learn about and understand, both for ourselves and for pets, and understanding, is it nature or nurture? How much do our genes have to do with who we are and how we are? So what does epigenetics mean?
Well, I think we all know genetics, and that has to do with genes and stuff. Epi, root word, a lot of people are actually familiar with it, but don't realize it. You may be familiar with like epithelial cells.
Yes.
Those are like skin cells. It means above or upon.
Oh, over. Interesting.
So it would be kind of like upon or over the genetics. And what it really relates to is an area which is a growing area of interest for lots of folks, where you can change how genes are expressed, whether they're used or not, if you will, by means that we weren't previously fully aware of, meaning that we used to think if you had a gene, then you had the whatever it coded for would occur. If you had a mutation in that gene, then you would have that mutation expressed or would be part of you.
And or you could be a carrier and benign, if you will.
Right. And I think that I'll start by saying we're all very aware of twins, identical twins,
yes,
carrying the same genetics. But if you look at twins in an adult life that were once identical, they may no longer look identical. And so what's causing that? And there's a lot of discussions about the environmental impact. And certainly, I'm not just talking about maybe, you know, one got overweight and one didn't. But
right,
if you think that there's a genetic cause or component to whether you're going to become obese or not, then it's the appearance difference from a researcher or science perspective is not so much the fact, of course, the one that looks thinner looks different than the one that looks heavier. It's more about the fact, why did one become heavy,
right,
and one didn't? And what choices and what difference experiences on that were played upon by the same on the same genes cause this. And what we've learned is what we are learning is that there are basically ways in which diet, for example, toxins as well, can affect which genes are expressed. And that's all good and well for the individual. But what's really fascinating is that some of this impact can be then passed on to offspring. And that's really the most revolutionary aspect, because now you have permanently changed or altered, in essence, your genetics because of how you have changed whether it's going to be expressed or not. And a lot of this, and I think I alluded to this, if not previously, very, very briefly, or if it was off air, some of the interesting work, at least on the human side, was related to World War II and what's referred to as the Dutch Hunger Winter, in a very discrete period of time where there wasn't enough food, and looking at the offspring of those folks. And what they found, which was really interesting, is that if the child was in utero, so in the womb,
right,
and it overlapped for the first 3 months of pregnancy when the famine and food was scarce, versus even if it was throughout pregnancy that it was food was scarce, that the children that were really malnourished early in their development, those first 3 months, later went on as adults to have higher rates of obesity than even siblings. So you would expect very,
right,
similar genetics. And you could actually correlate that to changes in what now we believe one of the mechanisms called methylation or methyl groups on the DNA, and that had lifelong immeasurable impacts on gene expression even 6 decades later and on children. And there's debate that it may even be impacting the grandchildren as well. And even the starved children or in utero children, if it was throughout their whole pregnancy, they were born smaller, but they actually, interestingly enough, stayed and had lower obesity rates later in life. And so it seems that if your mother was having poor malnourishment early on in pregnancy, you developed a very thrifty, if you will, very efficient user of calories, is a term I've used in the past, profile, which then increased your odds of becoming obese as an adult in life.
Which is quite fascinating, because thrifty is very positive. You're like, gee, nice use of your calories, pal. You took those calories and you turned them into, you know, safety fuel for later, which is what fat is, especially in babies. You look at someone like Princess Kate in England, who had severe vomiting in the first 3 months of that pregnancy. And some women do, to the point of not being able to keep anything down, put in the hospital on IV fluids. They would be a perfect example of complete malnutrition for the mother during those formative 3 months. I wonder if those babies, even living in the lap of, you know, Buckingham Palace, where every foodstuff was available, but not to that infant in utero, I wonder how that affects later.
It will be interesting. And I think we have to remember that there are a lot of factors. And so if you take any individual, it may not lead to it, because maybe when that child grows up, we'll have the best of nutritionists and it'll have an active lifestyle, you know, hunting or whatever they do in English royalty. But as a whole, if you take across lots, and so they had lots of individuals to look at and looking at these folks that suffer from this Dutch hunger winter, that you do see a higher incidence or rate of obesity because of it. And it really raises some interesting questions and questions that, you know, have really profound implications, because maybe the differences that we see, and you try to look for genetic differences at times, you miss that because you don't know the epigenetics of the individual and what's been going on in the past. And it's a really, really interesting question that it is posed, because there are impacts on cancer. And so there are drugs now that look at, you know, methylation and trying to affect that. And having an impact on the outcome of cancers, certainly an area I don't have any expertise in whatsoever, but it has far-reaching implications beyond just diet and weight that I think we're going to learn more and more about. And interesting impact on us, because methylation really has to do with methyl groups. So methyl groups are basically a structure that comes from things that in the diet. And so there's some work where they've actually taken mice and they actually gave them methyl group rich diets. And then they changed in one example, pigment in later generations. So hair color in later generations, by just giving more of these methyl groups, which then you would anticipate cause differences in methylation. And they've shown some of that to be the case. And we will say, well, what are these methyl groups? Well, we always refer to methyl group donors. And the two big ones that people may be aware of, one is methionine, which is a sulfur amino acid, very rich in animal proteins, not so rich in legumes, and choline. So you'll see sometimes now some more recent advertisements for choline, that's C-H-O-L-I-N-E, for children's multivitamins. You start seeing them advertise that.
Oh, how curious.
And it's really interesting. It has a lot of effects on neurologic development and things. And so it's really a very interesting question. And what the question that I really wonder about, and I'm making a big jump I'm about to, which is always a dangerous thing, but it really is, we think about, why are there cats in the same household, even on similar foods, that become overweight or obese and others that don't? And there's certainly probably a genetic component, but how much of that has to do with the genetics, or I'm going to argue the diet potentially of,
yes,
the mother?
So, I mean, you had, let's say one of your cats is a Maine Coon cat. That's the fifth generation of purpose-bred Maine Coon cats. all the moms and dads of which had great nutrition and a wonderful parasite control. And the other cats were strays. Maybe their previous generation was feral. So they were, you know, there may have been times they were starving and didn't have food at all. Right.
And does that then lead to an increased risk of obesity? The research to this date, there's not any in cats that I'm aware of, would suggest that there is a role that this is playing. And what's interesting to me is if we think about methionine and methyl donors or methyl groups, is that those are often limiting in a lot of cat diets. If you're making a legume, remember I mentioned legumes are low in methionine, but if you're making a legume-based diet, a soy-based diet, and relying on it as a main source of protein, which you certainly can on lower cost foods, is there less methionine in that? And does that have any impact, especially if you're, you know, having a very early on in the development, you may have not even thought of switching over your cat or will even add your dog to a diet appropriate for it's more protein rich, if you will, or maybe richer in amino acids. And it's not uncommon that you'll see methionine added in. Now, sometimes in cat foods, it's added for acidifying purposes, but often it's added because it is the limiting amino acid. And does that mean that you're just at the requirement? And what does that have impact on epigenetics? Now, that's a very big leap I just made, but it is an interesting concept based on what we do know that if you give more of them and make a methyl rich diet, that you can impact the offspring of rodents. What implications does that have to our dog and cat friends?
And then we look at populations of feral dogs, whether it's India, Mexico, any of the countries where there's huge populations of unowned dogs that are skin and bones and scavenge as best they can to barely stay alive. They're none of them spayed or neutered. So they reproduce. And does that create more and more generations of dogs able to live on very, very little and who remain skin and bones, because it's not like their ship ever comes in. There's no day when it's like, okay, food bar for the wild dogs or the free, you know, the loose dogs.
Right. And what does it say if we just think about if this is a long multi-generation issue, the good times for dogs everywhere in the world only started rolling in the developed world in the last few hundred years.
Yes.
And so have we been selecting for genetics, and maybe it's not epigenetics, but just genetics in general for efficient users of calories? I always argue that a Labrador, you know, that had to do highly energetic swimming and, you know, survive in cold temperatures, there's a reason that was probably selected to be really an efficient user of calories. Now you put it in the land of surplus and give it all the food it wants. It's not surprising that labs struggle to keep their weight the way
and they should. And so little exercise, at least certainly not equal to many hours of running and swimming and
that's
fetching.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, that's another really good point. And then, you know, the thing you touched on is another interesting issue, be it for breeding animals or breeding humans. You said, well, maybe you didn't switch your cat over to a really high-quality protein diet more appropriate for the hypercarnivore because you didn't know it or you didn't realize it or you didn't know the cat was pregnant. What about people? The idea that women that are of a childbearing age and desire at some point to have children, maybe they should be on so-called pregnancy vitamins a lot earlier than when they actually discover 6 or 8 weeks in that they're pregnant. Because you've already lost 2 months of the critical 3 months, if we're calling those 3 months of development so hypercritical.
Right. And I think it's a really interesting question that I think we're going to learn more about, and I'm sure that a lot more knowledgeable people than me are already working on. But it does raise the discussion of, well, good nutritional playing is probably really important if you're starting to think, yeah, let's breed. And I'm not talking about humans, I'm talking about dogs and cats and stuff. And it's an interesting thing because historically what we really have worried about is late gestation. So that's late pregnancy and really important lactation. And so a lot of the focus has been on lactation and making sure the diet is nutrient dense and appropriate to support lactation. And we don't often worry about early on and say to people, well, you really already should be going on to a higher protein diet for your cat or your dog because you're considering breeding it. Now, there is some anecdotal evidence that at least in some research colonies where they're trying to do breeding, that they have increased reproductive success on higher protein diets, and bigger litter sizes, more robust litter sizes. But I think that the question of what does that do to them lifelong is a really interesting one, and one that I think that, you know, others far more clever than me that do a lot of genetic work and do this type of research really should, I think, start looking into, because it may have some profound effect. It may explain the differences we see in what we would refer to as phenotype, meaning how the genetics are actually manifested, what the end individual looks like.
Yeah, in fact, there's someone whose dog Fritz is now on the Halo Healthy Weight Challenge that Dr. Donna Spector and I are doing on the Expert Vet. And she has these two dogs that she adopted from Southern Rescues that came up to Westchester on a regular basis from certain shelters in the South, where there's way too many pets and way too few homes for them. And one dog has really leaning towards obesity. In fact, he's on this Healthy Weight Challenge because at age two, he went from 40 pounds to 49.5 pounds just suddenly. And the other dog is real slender and doesn't care that much about food. Now, they're obviously not litter mates. They come from different areas, but they're about the same size dog, and that same kind of random what dogs look like after two or three generations of just, like, you know, breeding amongst themselves, which I guess has been noted by those who note these things. They have a kind of a curled up tail and a certain kind of coat and certain kind of ears and head shape. And she's so curious why one dog is so ravenously hungry and packing on the pounds. And she's working her butt off to get those pounds off and to get them through it. I mean, your zucchini idea has been so valuable, but I've got to share with you, people have now seen it on Facebook. Fritz loves zucchini. She made a video of herself and her little young school-aged boys feeding Fritz his zucchini snack because he's dying of starvation. And he does a dance when they say, "Do you want zucchini?" And thanks to Sean Delaney, sweet. This poor dog, all he gets when he's starving to death is these chunks of lightly parboiled zucchini. And you'd think he was being offered filet mignon on a skewer. It is adorable.
I'm glad I could help with his satiety. I'm obviously not involved in his management, but I do feel a little redeemed, because I think the first time I suggested this for your own dog when you were having some weight challenges and trying to get
Teddy,
some satiety,
yes,
you poo-pooed the idea and laughed a little bit at it, not too, but hurt my feelings just a little.
Oh, did I? How rude of me. No, I mean, I needed all the help I could get. And it turned out that I was overcooking it, because the way that Dr. Donna, apparently, and this lady Holly, the way theirs is parboiled, and the little boy, who's all of five, you hear him in the video going, "Wow, Fritz really loves that zucchini." It's sort of like that ad, "Mikey likes it." So it turns out the little boy now goes in the fridge and takes pieces of this lightly parboiled zucchini as a snack for himself. The dog is totally encouraging the kid.
Zucchini can be very popular. My own daughters love zucchini.
So funny. Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes,
isn't that,
like,
funny?
Make extra, like, a mountain of it, because especially my oldest, she'll go through it so quickly. And the first time my mother made some zucchini, because I said they liked it, and she goes, "Oh, I make zucchini all the time." She didn't make enough, and, you know, I could hear it in the back of her mind thinking, "Yeah, right, your daughter likes zucchini," yeah, which means it probably
one bite.
Points. No, that was like two or three zucchinis worth, you know.
Wow, that's crazy. Well, it was very helpful, but she, the owner, is confused and frustrated. Why is this one dog so hungry and gotten so fat so quickly? And now it turns out his mom may have been a starving mongrel, or his grandmother, and his genes are saying, "Pack on the pounds now, honey, while the getting's good," right?
That's exactly right. And I think that that's the key, is that maybe people are going, "Well, what can I do? I can't build
right.
a time machine and
right.
go back and change what happened." And what we can learn from this is that it just reinforces that we need to be cautious about the environment we put our pet in. And the feeding trough mentality of leaving food out at all times with a full bowl for those dogs is just not going to be a really good option, and it's going to lead to them having an increased risk of obesity.
And even of bloat. I mean, I had a dog, the dog trainer said to me, this dog, Billy Blue, that was from the Weimaraner Rescue in Sunland, California, called Friends for Pets. This dog, I got him at 6 months. It was a relinquishment by the owners with his papers. They'd come from a proper breeder, but they were older couple, and it was much more dog than than they really could handle. And he was a very tightly wound guy. I mean, if Weimaraners leaned towards neurotic, this guy was like the standard, the flag bearer for that. And he worried about everything all the time. Are you really ever going to come back? Is that door going to stay open long enough for me to go through it? Will there ever be more food right after eating? So eating was a big issue for him, and weight gain. So she said, Amy Sadler, really now famous dog trainer, I was her first client ever, and we didn't believe in free feeding. It was a concept that's pretty much now, I think, gone by the wayside. But at the time, the idea of free feeding was around. It was like, if a dog sees the food's always around, he'll calm down, he'll just take a few bites here and there, he'll kind of graze. You'd fill the bowl, and you'd come back 5 minutes later, and it was empty, and you fill it, and he would empty it. And this went on for 10 days. She said, just give it some time, give it some time. He ballooned up like the Michelin man. Whatever you put in the bowl at any time, he would rush and empty it. He was driven by, I guess, his genes. And he came from a real breeder, not a puppy mill. So his mom, and I hope his grandmother also, had a nice life. You know, there was regular food and water and parasite control. So there you have a curious situation.
Well, you know, it's really interesting is that we have to remember that the wolf will take down large prey species and they'll eat and literally wolf down and go into a meat coma because they'll eat so much and they may not eat for 2 or 3 days. And given that the dog is a subspecies of the wolf, we can't get past that behavior. And you'll
right.
certainly see dogs that will almost eat to exploding point. And I think I've shared this before, but it's always worth sharing because it's a funny anecdote. But when I was doing emergency work early in my career, before doing residency, I had a Labrador that presented for bloat. And, you know, I'd seen a lot of bloat by that point, and I ausculted, which is just a fancy word of saying I listened with
right.
my stethoscope. And you normally get a gassy ping when you do that. And instead of when you kind of flicked the hugely distended abdomen, it was just like a thud. And so I'm like, And I said,
not empty, not full of air and gas.
No, it was not likely, but I said, did the dog have any access to food or, you know, eat anything? Oh, no, doctor, not possible, not possible. He swore up and down and, you know, thought I was insane. I said, well, okay, we'll take a radiograph or an x-ray. And sure enough, I could see all this, you know, food looks very distinct and very different than gas. It's black when you
right.
get a radiograph and food looks like little kind of mushiness and there's white opacity to it. Anyway, it was very clearly food. So I put the radiograph up and also the actual shape of the stomach, you could tell hadn't torsed or turned on itself, and said, there's food in here. And I said, there's nothing for me to do except for give lots of access to water, expect a lot of defecation,
right.
maybe hold off a few meals or decrease a few meals for the next few days. And so anyway, they looked at me and, you know, I was a younger vet at the time and really doubtful, but they, you know, faced with the x-ray and my confidence, they didn't have a lot of choices. And so they searched their house, and I got a call about 25 minutes after the end of the appointment. Doc, you were right. We found the food bag. He ate half the bag. We don't
yeah.
know how it's possible.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I said the danger of bloat, because Labrador retrievers and people will eat till they explode. I mean, the Roman vomitorium, you ate until you vomited so you could eat some more. So a lot of dogs don't actually vomit it. They just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and over time they pack it away as fat. I guess that really the message is that there's a genetic component to your dog's propensity to put on weight, and if you see it happening, you are going to be fighting that epigenetics, right? You're going to be fighting that throughout his life. It's not going to just change.
You're going to be fighting the epigenetics. You're going to be fighting the genetics, and you will be winning a losing battle because you have, as I would like to put it, a very finely tuned system of evolutionarily, historically improved individual that is superior if we were in a normal time of famine. And all the dogs that, you know, have to have tons of food to survive and maintain their weight would be starving and dying. And your dog that's he has a propensity to becoming overweight or obese would be going, I'll survive the
That's
lack
right.
of food.
That's
I'll,
right.
I'll make it to the next generation and have my, you know, pups and yeah, I'm hungry, but my body is really efficient and I'm going to make it through this.
I guess it with horses, when especially in situations where feed is expensive, you're always happy to have what they call an easy keeper. a horse who keeps their weight on without a ton of food. They just, you know, maintain a nice weight on an average amount of food. There's a lot of show horses and race horses that you have to shovel food at them all day long, the highest quality, highest protein alfalfa hay you can, just to hope that they'll put some on. And of course, in the survival of the fittest, they wouldn't have made it. They were not going to make it through another winter. Whereas the easy keeper is like, I could do this.
Right. And that's exactly what we face with our dog and cat friends, if you will. And I think that it's an important reminder, because I often, when I did weight loss management in clinical setting, I often had to deal with the fact that when you talk about all the consequences of being overweight or obese, that there's inherent guilt that comes with that. And I find it's freeing for folks to realize that they're not to blame, and that often that a lot of it is because of the different genetics, and that, and to realize that not just that, you know, I think people put a negative stigmatism, if you will, or stigma with regard to overweightedness and obesity, and that it's a failure, that it has some, you know, problem associated with it, that you've done something wrong. And when you say, hey, wait a minute, you have a genetically superior animal
for an
environment where there's not a lot of calories, it just puts everything back in the
mindset. And that dog or cat, but more the dog in these situations, are going to save you a lot of money. Because
that's
to maintain that lighter weight, which is the only thing you can do for optimal health, you need to buy a lot less of that costly food and feed a lot less of it. Not just can you, but you must. You've got to limit the amount of calories they take in, because they're making such good use of them.
And it could be half as much as it could have cost you. Because I think what we can remember is that the individual variation of energy need is typically plus or minus 50%. So there's some animals that need 50% less than you would typically calculate, and some that need 50% more, which means, let's say they need 300 calories, there's some that are going to need 400 calories and some that need 200 calories. So if you were lucky and got the dog or the cat needed 200 calories instead of 400 calories, you're going to get to feed half as much and thus only need to spend half as much.
That's right.
The dog that needs
and pick up half as much duty and all the rest of it. So it's something to embrace.
And like our last show, environmentally, that's a lot friendlier too.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's the most efficient possible use of those calories. The what did we call it last week? The
feed conversion.
I was going to say food conversion. Well, guys, that's it. Last week was insects, and today was, are we driven by our genetics? It's not an excuse to go eat more cake, okay? It's just an understanding that if you eat more cake, it's going to cost you twice as much on the scale as your neighbor down the street whose mom or grandmom or great-grandmom had a very well-fed first 3 months of that person's time in utero. God, I tell you, the sins of the fathers, right?
That's exactly right.
Have a great night, Sean. Thanks again for another great show. Thank you all for listening.
You too, Tracy.